I held on to the hem of the robe of God. I went into a state of transcendental consciousness and God consciousness, and as I did so, my individuality disappeared into the infinite, and this violent group lost their hold on me. Once in the unbounded, this system could no longer hold me. There was no me there, you see what I'm saying? Leave thyself behind and then walk upon the water. Be as nothing, and then be everywhere. I have told people who are being targeted with these systems, the only way to escape them is to understand the power of transcending self and letting the drop of your individuality merge with the ocean of unboundedness. But as soon as I re-emerged into my individuality and consciousness, the attack would begin all over again. It was one of the worst things I've ever experienced. They were clearly trying to grab my individuality, extract my astral being, and put me through their abduction sequence. Now, remember, if you cause enough trauma to the astral body, it can manifest in the physical. This is something many people don't understand. Most of these abduction events are actualized by technologies that can extract the astral body from the physical body. Project Amethyst, run by a black cell at the NSA, killed people by severing the cord between the astral body and the physical body. I know a guy who ran that program. This experience was, in a way, a gift, because they tipped their hand and they showed me exactly what they had done to the Secretary General and what they had done to the brother of Princess A. I was then able to remote view back through this electronic beam and see the people in the facility, all human, that were running it. You see, anything that comes at you, if you stay calm and centered and in this transcendental state of consciousness, you can track back to its source and expose them. So, every time they've hit me, that's what I've done. And that's how I've seen what they're doing. I have to admit, this was one of the most difficult things I have had to do, to stay in control of my own faculties while this was happening, so I could quickly escape the bounds of relativity, enter into the plane of the absolute, where they couldn't get me, because I didn't exist any more. My daughter, thank God, was protected from all this and had no knowledge of any of it. So, that was our little trip to New York. I have independently confirmed that some of the mid-level apparatchiks of this covert shadow group, which include a former US president, were in favor of disclosing this information in the late 1980s. But there was another group that trumped them, and it is a faction within this larger control group. This cell has the abduction technologies, and they have the scalar psychotronic weapons systems and radionic weapons systems. They also have the ARVs, alien reproduction vehicles, that look like UFOs and operate with new energy and anti-gravity propulsion systems. This cell uses these advanced technologies to contain disclosure on an official level, up to and including threatening the leadership of the world and abducting a world leader, like a Secretary General of the United Nations. After this near pseudo abduction experience in New York, I recalled a lucid dream I had around 1990-1991. In the dream, I was floating above Kennebunkport, Maine and saw something that was really very disturbing. I saw the United States President, George Bush, at his compound there. There were objects in the sky that looked like UFOs, but were actually manned by paramilitary rogue elements. They were flying around the compound, and out at sea, and were threatening the US president. The Secret Service and George Bush were very worried about this. It made no sense to me at the time that I saw it. But after this meeting, where I learned what the prince told me about the abduction of Perez de Cuellar, I understood who was doing it and why. I also realized that, at the end of the Cold War, there was a sincere attempt to get this information out to the public, and that this cell within a cell, this rogue, violent, and very dangerous group, had stopped it. That was in late 89. And it was January of 90 that I was told to pick up that which I had dropped. Even though, to the rogue group I am an insignificant person and have no temporal power or official position, because officialdom got stopped dead in its tracks, mysteriously, somehow I was being called to help. People like Col. M.K., who is known as Dr. Death and has a PhD in Thanatology, the study of death, are masters of psychotronics and high-tech electronic systems that are responsible for abductions, mind control, and similar attacks. So, when you realize what our leaders are up against, it doesn't matter if they're skull and bones, and it doesn't matter if they're a former CIA director, if they try to step out of line, they run into this other group. This inner high cabal is hell-bent on keeping this subject tied up until there is a worst-case scenario. Their objective is the elimination of at least 4 to 5 billion of the 6 billion people on Earth. After returning from this event in New York in 1994, I experienced the horrifying force of the shadow government. Every night at 4:20 a.m., as I was sleeping in my bedroom at home, there would be an almost sub-audible click, and I would be hit with an electronic weapons system. I would become violently ill and so sick that I would get up and be nauseated, vomiting, with diarrhea, diaphoretic. The bathroom floor would literally be soaked with sweat, because I had almost no blood pressure, and I would collapse on the floor of the bedroom, near death. This happened to me night after night after night, day after day. It was horrifying. It lasted for only 10 or 15 minutes. I know that this rogue group was trying to make me stop what I was doing, but I refused to stop. During this period, I remember one night going to sleep and suddenly seeing someone with this group at an electronic control panel. It was an array of psychotronic and radionic high tech equipment at an underground facility out west. Clearly saw the handler for this particular operation standing outside the entrance to an underground weapons facility. He was a middle-aged man with a mustache and graying hair. I know exactly how he looks. He was assigned to my case. Inside this facility were some young men who were the grunts, the cannon fodder, operating this system to hit me. When I saw them, I turned to God and I said, "Dear God, forgive them," and sent them a blessing. I saw them very clearly and then I saw them seeing me. They had such a look of shame in their eyes. They looked away, and it all ended. After this, they stopped these nighttime attacks. I later learned that the poor people who run these devices often end up dying from what they're doing, that if they're projecting a disease onto someone, they get it. As usual, the operators and lower-rung personnel are cannon fodder. They don't know it when they take the assignment. And that's why these handlers were outside the building from which the system was being operated. I learned from this experience that, as these weapons were being directed at me, I could track back on the scalar electronic system, back to the source and see what they were doing. I would then put divine light around all of us and ask for their forgiveness, and also forgive them myself. Around the same time, I learned that Colin Andrews, the crop circle researcher from England, was experiencing some weird happenings, also in the early morning, preceded by this strange sub-audible click. I was tested severely during those years to see whether I would stay on this course. I was extremely close, in the summer of 1994, to closing XETI, ending the disclosure project, and just walking away from all of it. I tell people, visualize what happened on the last day, the last hour, the last 5 minutes of my last shift at the emergency department where I worked for 10 years. A little boy was at a picnic, and he choked to death. He could not be resuscitated at the scene, and was brought into the air. He was a beautiful little boy with blonde hair and about 3 or 4 years old. We worked on him for an hour, but he was already flatline when he arrived. He died in my arms. And in comes his big bear of a father, who collapses in my arms, weeping and screaming, a blood-curdling cry like you've never heard, when I tell him his son is dead. Dealing with this subject every day is orders of magnitude more traumatic for me than that. And for the nurses and me, having a little child die on my last day was as bad as it gets. Hearing about XETI experiences is like listening to a version of the X-Files, but this isn't Hollywood. It's the real thing. There are aspects of my work that are wonderful and beautiful, and there are other aspects of this effort that are enormously painful and tragic. Perhaps this is a perfect metaphor of the times in which we live. There's so much beauty and promise, and yet there's also so much suffering. Wyoming, outside of Laramie. We got there about sunset, and were doing our contact protocols. Right as the sun was going down, suddenly a brilliant, disc-shaped UFO appeared on top of a cloud and hovered. It winked in and out of the cloud and was signaling to the whole group. Dorothy had never seen such a thing. I explained, they're here, and they're very much connected with us all the time. They know when we're going to go out and do this 5 contact protocol. Often, when we would arrive onto a site to do this work, the ETs would already be there, because I would have told them where we were going and what time we'd be there. Dorothy was just amazed, and she exclaimed, Burl has got to meet you. We left from Denver and flew to Seattle and then drove up to their home in Anacortes, right on the water. Burl and I became fast friends. The way you would see him on the stage is exactly the way he was in person. One of the greats of the 20th century, by any account. We met for a long time discussing a plethora of issues. The secrecy, the technologies, ET contact. You know, this is the most sane crazy son you've ever introduced me to, he told Dorothy, who was always meeting interesting and eccentric people. He understood that what we were dealing with was something that had a lot of profound dimensions to it and that our approach was very rational and very sane, given how far out all this is. Dorothy initially didn't quite know who I really was or the extent to which I had deep contacts within the intelligence and national security community. Eventually, this came up and I told her, there's a man whose family has deep ties with the National Security Agency. They are senior NSA people, and are handing off some documents to me. One of these documents was a big, oversized Xerox copy of a 1962 document. It had code names like Project Moondust, Project 46, on it and it was classified top secret, but had not been declassified. It was given to me so I could get it to the right people. This document was a wiretap transcript summary of what they learned from listening in on Marilyn Monroe. This document has been authenticated by the top document authenticator in the world. An FBI agent told me, you know, you can go to jail for X number of years and be fined thousands of dollars each time you show this to anyone. I said, really? I've already shown it to a few thousand people. Come put the handcuffs on. My first call will be to Ted Koppel or Larry King, and not to some lawyer. He looked at me like I was crazy, and I said, you think I'm kidding? Try me. Here's the headline, emergency doctor goes to jail because he revealed a document that confirms that spooks at the agency whacked Marilyn Monroe before they ended up whacking the president. Now, I said, you want that to hit the front page? Come get me. He just shook his head with a look of shock, but they left me alone. We never heard from that spook again. This document describes how Marilyn Monroe, who had been recently jilted by the Kennedy brothers and was upset and hurt, called Robert Kennedy and a socialite in New York, an art dealer friend of hers. Marilyn Monroe stated that she was going to set up a press conference and tell the public what Jack Kennedy had told her regarding objects from outer space that had crashed and been retrieved in New Mexico in the 1940s. President Kennedy had confided this information to her, because he had seen the ET craft and debris from the UFO crash there. This still, top, secret document is dated the day before the night they found Marilyn Monroe dead. I've also located someone who was with the Los Angeles Police Department intelligence unit that helped facilitate the wiretapping and monitoring of her up to the time of her death and actually knew how they killed Marilyn Monroe. There is no doubt that she was murdered by cut-out agents of the U.S. intelligence community. Importantly, this document was signed by James Angleton, the legendary, fanatical mole hunter and leak stopper within the CIA. This document, in my opinion, was a death warrant for Marilyn Monroe, because it summarized what she was intending to do rather imminently. I don't think she knew what she had stumbled onto, in terms of the kind of buzzsaw that was going to come at her. I'm now working with someone who has similar documentation on the murder of Mary Meyer. Mary Meyer was their long-term paramour of Jack Kennedy, who was shot on the sea and oak canal path in Georgetown, back in 1964, because she knew too much. This contact has identified sources that knew why they murdered Meyer. And it's the same reason they murdered Marilyn Monroe. When I mentioned all this to Burl, he said, "Marilyn Monroe and I knew each other very well, and I can tell you this, all of us who knew her knew that she had been murdered, but it wasn't until today that I knew why." Some of the people that Burl knew were good friends with Ronald Reagan. He was able to confirm information that I had heard from other sources. For example, I have met two people who were with Ronald Reagan during the screening of Close Encounters of the Third Kind by Steven Spielberg. This movie is actually a documentary or docudrama, since most of what is depicted came from Air Force files that Spielberg secretly had access to at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Ronald Reagan turned to the people who were at the screening at the White House and said, "There are only a couple people in this room who know how true what this movie is portraying is." This was repeated to me by two separate witnesses. Most people don't realize that one of the chief control points for the secrecy is the mobbed up culture of money and corruption in Hollywood and the big media. It's very much infiltrated by interests of the national security shadow state. Of course, when you're someone like Burl Ives, you know everyone and everyone knows you. So, one meeting led to another, and I ended up meeting a number of celebrities. What I found from some of these meetings was that the UFO matter was an open secret. People knew it was real and that there had been assassinations and murders to keep it secret. Hollywood and the entire film and media industry was mobbed, up, top down, with control points that had become more and more entrenched, as time went on. I learned from a number of people that you can't really do films on the subject of ETs anymore unless there's a heavy militaristic, xenophobic overlay. We went from Close Encounters of the Third Kind and E.T. to movies like Independence Day and silly things like Men in Black or Mars Attack. These movies all have an invasion or military conflict theme. These covert interests want the populace brain washed via this type of propaganda to the falsehood of alien hostility. Hollywood, and the media in general, are key control points. After I taught Dorothy how to do the Xetis Five protocols, she decided to practice them one afternoon while sitting on the edge of the ocean at Anna Courts, Washington. She was with one of her grandchildren, and suddenly a UFO appeared. It was going in and out of the clouds and communicating and signaling with her. Her granddaughter said, "Oh, God, look at that." And it was then that Dorothy knew she had this connection and could make contact. During the LA Northridge earthquake in the 1990s, Dorothy woke up around 4:30 Pacific time and went downstairs. As she looked outside, she saw a golden light coming through the foyer windows. She looked outside at the source of the light and saw a large extraterrestrial vehicle, just right above the tree line. And she was in the beam of light. She immediately began to receive a message mentally, "Do not be afraid, you will be safe, we are always with you, you will be protected." She instantly felt compelled to call her best friend in LA, just as the Northridge earthquake was happening. This woman said, "Oh, we're having an earthquake, but you won't believe what's here." And she told Dorothy, "There's this dish-shaped craft with golden light coming from it, and I'm in a beam, and I'm getting this message that says, do not be afraid, you will be safe. We are with you, and you will be protected." It was exactly the same message, at the same instant, coming from identical craft that had placed them in this golden light. It was as if there was no separation in space, or that the AT craft had bi-located and was in two places at once. Dorothy called and told me what had happened. I told her that there might be a lot of changes in the world, including the potential for major geophysical and other changes, and that these extraterrestrial people are connected to us and will help stabilize the Earth and protect humanity. An interesting encounter happened when I was invited to Cambridge University in the 1990s to give a lecture to the International Conference of Mensa, which is a high IQ group. I made a very serious, mainstream, data-oriented, scientifically-oriented presentation. At the end of my talk, an elderly man stood up and said, "I'll have you know that I'm Dr. So, and, so. And I've been on this committee and that committee in the British government. And if there was any truth to this, I would know about it. Moreover, I find it utterly depressing that a man of your intelligence would be wasting your life on such drivel." His neck veins were popping out and his face was red with anger. This, in front of hundreds of people. I said, "Well, with all due respect, if there's even a 10% chance that this is true and there are technologies that enable interstellar travel and could run this planet without pollution or poverty for thousands of years and create a sustainable world, it's worth my career and any sacrifice we make. Next question." So, now, the postscript to this: we had a banquet in one of the grand halls at Cambridge that's still illumined with torches and candles. As I was leaving the banquet, I heard feet running up behind me, clack, 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 clack. There were a couple of young scientists who had been with this senior scientist who had been so agitated by my talk. They said, "We wanted to apologize for Dr. So, and, So's behavior." And I said, "Oh, that's okay, I've been called every name in the book, and I'm used to that." Then they said, "No, you don't understand. He was so upset not because he didn't think it was true, but because he's an eminent scientist and a physicist, and deep inside, he thought maybe it really was true, and it meant everything he knew and had been teaching for 60 years of his career was rubbish." This man thought, "My God, if this is true, and I think it could be, then what I know about science and physics is a fairy tale and isn't even kindergarten level science. And if this is true, being an eminent scientist at Cambridge did not change that fact. This is a phenomenon that I have seen over and over again. I have been the UN fortunate person who's had to walk into meetings with the likes of a Lord Hill Norton, or the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, or someone who's a senior scientist with the National Science Foundation and share this information with them. These are important people, in important positions. And yet they realize there is an entire universe of operations, technology, science and power beyond their control. It is very disturbing. Many come to realize that they are a pawn or a cog in a machine not of their making, or liking. It is traumatic to learn this when they're at what they consider the apex of their career and power. There are a number of predictable responses: anger, denial, accept, ants, fear. In the mid-90s, I was invited by the board of directors of Natick Sciences to do a briefing for their board. The founder of Natick Sciences was there along with a number of very prominent people. I presented what we were doing, what our findings were, what the evidence was. They also had a few disinformation people present who, at one time, had done good work in the field, but who had since been bought off by intelligence interests. One such asset of the shadow government made a presentation saying, "This is all a mythology, and there are these little balls of light occasionally seen." He completely whitewashed all the hard evidence that he once wrote about. It was a very interesting thing to watch. I then stood up and politely said, "Well, on the contrary. Also, he was proposing, of course, these things don't actually exist in the physical world because they're inter-dimensional." I said, "Well, inter-dimensional means nothing, insofar as a flower is inter-dimensional because it has folded within it everything from the physical reality of the flower to the astral form and light that is within it, to the idea form, the causal idea of the flower, and the actual conscious intelligence that created it and that sustains it is still present within the flower. So everything is inter-dimensional. There's nothing that isn't." I said, "Look at your own selves. You have within yourself an opening to the infinite mind, and all the universe that's folded within it, as well as your own so-called causal body, as the mystics would call the idea form of what you are. And within and supporting your physical body is your astral body, the body of light that you can fly around within lucid dreams or at other times." I said, The human being is completely inter-dimensional, or trans-dimensional, and encompasses every fine and infinite level of creation all the way to the grossest manifestation, the physical. So, what are we talking about when we say inter-dimensional? It means nothing to say this. Everything is inter-dimensional. The question is, are you in touch with enough dimensions to express them? Well, an adept, in India, may be able to materialize his body and become invisible. Or he might be able to manifest a ring or an object. But an extraterrestrial civilization may be able to do the same things through both mental capabilities and technological assistance. So, the fact that there are inter-dimensional expressions of ET technology does not mean they're not extraterrestrial or physical. It's not an either/or question. Such an argument is like two people debating whether an orange is round or the color orange, when it's both orange, the color, and round. That night, we were hosted by Paul and Diane Temple for dinner. They are venture capitalists and have a large estate next to George Lucas Ranch, near San Rafael, California. Senator Claiborne Pell was also there for the dinner. Senator Pell really epitomized the best of our leaders. He was a very enlightened man. Senator Pell knew what we were doing. I had worked with some of his staff and aides. So we met in California in San Rafael at this hilltop home. Senator Pell, Emily and I stepped between huge lilac doors that opened out onto the patio. We began to talk out under the stars. Senator Pell looked at me through his black horn-rimmed glasses and said, "You know, Dr. Greer, I've been interested in this for years, and I've been in the Congress since Jack Kennedy was a congressman. I've been on every committee, and have made inquiries into this, and I've never gotten a straight answer." He then asked, "Would you be willing to come and brief my staff on this and share with us what you know?" "Well, Senator, I'd be very happy to do that, anytime we can set it up," I answered. He then said, "But I don't know why they wouldn't tell me. Why have I been kept in the dark?" I made a few comments, as I have to others, about why. The why is always the hardest thing to answer, the most painful thing to answer, actually. "You know, Senator Pell, it's a crying shame, because here you are, one of the truly enlightened members of the Senate. You could do so much good as chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, but you have been deprived of dealing with the ultimate foreign relations issue." I said this, pointing to the stars above our head. He looked at me and blinked through his horn-rimmed glasses and said, "Well, Dr. Greer, I'm afraid you may be right." I said, "Yes. You, and people like you, should have been the vanguards of the human race making contact with these peoples and managing these technologies and managing our relations with them, instead of a rogue kleptocracy stealing it from us. The entire time you have been in the Congress and Senate, you have been blocked from dealing with the most important issue of this century." It was a very poignant moment. I felt it very important for Senator Pell to understand what is at stake here. It isn't just about him knowing, it's about him and people like him who are in the constitutional chain of command of our country, and who could manage this well but who are deprived of doing so. He and Senator Byrd and Senator Bryan have been pushed out, and the whole matter has been hijacked out of legal oversight and control into a rogue, illegal covert management. Occasionally, when pressed, I have been asked, "Don't some of the members of the Congress know what's going on and are part of this effort to keep the secret?" Yes. And we know who they are. One of the people who is central to maintaining the status quo and is a major con point in blocking information at the level of the Congress is a senior senator, former Congressman George Brown of California, who is since deceased, was involved with this group and was responsible, as a member of the Science and Technology Committee, for keeping this quiet. There are other people who are cooperating with the secrecy, such as former chairman of the House Intelligence Committee and current CIA director, Porter Goss. I have provided information to him via a member of our team who is a very close family friend. The fact is that you only need a few points of control in these institutions to keep it secret. These players then go to their colleagues in the Congress and say, "I've had top access, and none of this is true." Memo to their colleagues, people lie.